Sergeant Spartan, you've been sentenced to 70 years, sub-zero rehabilitation in the California Cryo Penitentiary for the involuntary manslaughter of 30 innocent civilians.
Skip it.
You will be placed in cryostasis for the duration of your sentence, during which your behavior will be altered through synaptic suggestion. You'll be eligible for parole no earlier than the year 2046. I'm sorry, Sergeant.
Though it was critically hammered in its initial release, Demolition Man is the sci-fi lover's equivalent to Roadhouse. It's a film that, when screamed on television, never fails to entertain in its own empty calorie kind of way, and it never misses an opportunity to joke, reference, pun, or stab at everything from author Aldous Huxley to serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer. There's some sort of hypnotic comfort in Demolition Man now, which may never be considered a sci-fi classic, but has since become a big bag of cinematic potato chips. Once you open it, it's rather difficult to stop after just one taste. Good evening, welcome to another edition of Natsukashi, where we unearth our cinematic memories from their imprisonment and judge them after their passage of time. My name is Rob, and I will serve as your host, and joining us for this ep is Scott Knopf from He Shot Cyrus, and a returning guest, Mr. Glenn Shaddix, a.k.a. Associate Bob from the film. Mellow greetings, gentlemen.
Mellow greetings. Happy, happy.
Happy, happy. All right, so, Scott, you were but a young demolition boy when you watched this, so you wanted to revisit it for tonight's podcast. Why?
This is just one of those films that, like, will not go away. I think your intro completely summed up everything I was going to say.
Sorry.
No, like, I mean, you're totally right about it. It's like, if it's on TV, I watch it, and it's not I watch till the commercial. It's like, if I watch it, and even if something important is going on, I'm stuck with it for, like, the next hour and a half.
Yeah.
Because I just love it so much.
It's got an addictive quality about it. And I kind of felt like when I was watching this, that it's almost like Airplane. And I don't mean wild and zany. Well, yeah, it is in some scenes. But it's almost like Airplane in that there's no boring scenes. You know what I mean? Like, there's something going on in every single scene, whether it's verbal or visual or whatever.
We have become a society of peace, loving, and understanding, and we are, quite frankly, not equipped to deal with this situation.
There have been no deaths of unnatural causes in San Angeles in the last 16 years.
The Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, San Diego Metroplex were merged in 2011. You are in the center of what used to be Los Angeles.
That's great. You, give me a Marlboro.
Yes, of course, right away.
I got into Demolition Man because of my love for Judge Dredd, which came from my love for Diane Lane. So Diane Lane led me to Demolition Man.
Oh, I love Diane Lane. Yeah.
We could do a whole episode about Diane Lane.
I would love.
Yeah, listen, that lady.
All right. Well, Glenn, you had just finished the adaptation for Stephen King's Sleepwalker the year prior to this, and you also concurrently had Nightmare Before Christmas being released just a few weeks prior to this.
Yeah, we were actually still working, doing final touches. You know, I would Nightmare, I mainly would take day flights to San Francisco and work with Henry Selick, on the recording there. So, yeah, they both came out. In fact, they came out the same week. No, they didn't, because both were number one, so they came out different weeks. I don't know exactly. Right. Both came out in 93.
It was re-released, and the re-release at one point in the box office, I believe it was in your third week of release of Demolition Man, that you occupied. You had films that occupied both the number two and number three spots at the box office.
I never realized that.
Yes. So you had a 1-2 punch there, sir.
Well, that was a 93 was a good year for me.
Well, it opened, like you said, Glenn, it opened at number one on October 3rd, and it performed fairly well, earning about $58 million domestically, but it got double that bank overseas.
Stallone has that worldwide.
Right, yeah. And he starts, Sylvester Stallone, just to recap on this, Sylvester Stallone starred as the only in the movie's name of John Spartan. And he chased the equally unbelievably named Simon Phoenix, through played by a very over-the-top Wesley Snipes. through the streets of Los Angeles set in 2032.
But it starts in, like, 1996.
Right.
Right.
And then you get the frozen time to bring you to the future. Beautiful plot device.
You gotta put John Spartan on ice first.
No one puts John Spartan on ice. And in fact, it wasn't even ice, was it? It was kind of like a dishwashing liquid, really.
I don't know what the heck it was.
They were unfrozen.
Mr. Simon Phoenix, one of our first and most illustrious members. Allow me to welcome you to your parole here. Let's get this one over quick. 29 years ago, the parole system as you know it was rendered obsolete. Federal Statute 537-29. Stop it! Do you have anything fresh to say on your behalf? I thought not.
Yeah, I do. Teddy bear.
Then they reawaken in this world that is completely void. It was after some very violent times, and now it has become this, you know, completely different landscape altogether, where all things that were deemed bad for us have been made illegal, like alcohol, caffeine, contact sports.
Smoking is not good for you, and has been deemed that anything not good for you is bad, hence illegal. Alcohol, caffeine, contact sports, meat.
Are you shitting me?
John Spartan, you are fined one credit for a violation of the verbal morality statute.
What the hell is that?
John Spartan, you are fined one credit.
Bad language, chocolate, gasoline, uneducational toys, and anything spicy. Abortion is also illegal, but then again, so is pregnancy if you don't have a license.
And all restaurants are Taco Bell.
Or Pizza Hut, depending upon where you lived in the country, or where you lived in the world.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yes, they had to digitally alter this for whatever reason, I guess, for, you know...
Overseas?
Yeah, overseas it was Pizza Hut, and they had to...
That's a piece of trivia that I didn't know.
Yeah. We come prepared, Glenn.
Well, you certainly do. The way it began for me, it was one of those fun things because I didn't have to audition. I was sitting at my mother's house talking to my cousin in Alabama, and I get a phone call, and it's the casting director, and she essentially says, "You've got this part," and I'm like, "Oh yeah, but we need you to come to L.A., you know, ASAP and meet with Marco Brambilla." And I said, "Well, I'm on my way." And Marco had directed, you know, he was from Milan and had directed a lot of commercials, mainly. I'll tell you right now, right off the bat, let's just get Joel Silver straight. Joel Silver can't digest lunch if he hasn't fired somebody before.
Cleanse the palate a little.
Oh, I tell you, there's not many people like this guy. He lives in a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Hollywood Hills, and he always says, "Judge me by my art, not by my movies. I make them for 14-year-olds. It's a quote, direct quote. And he was rude, abrasive, and called the shots. I think he really hired Marco Brambilla just so that he could really control it. And he certainly did. Well, he's got the chops for action pictures. He's, you know, he's done enough. And I didn't like the man, but I was appreciative of the job.
Dr. Cocteau, a cryocon has effected self-release from the penitentiary. It's quite horrific. Murder, death, kills, all categories of chaos.
Enhance your calm. Enhance your...
I did pull a little fun thing. I incorporated halfway through the film. In other words, I started out as being hired as Glenn Shaddix with a social security number. Then I started my corporation, Nine Moon Productions. It worked out. I convinced Joel that my character was much too likable. In the original script, Associate Bob was going to be shot by John Spartan, Stallone. And I said, look, we've gone in such a way as to make him so somewhat innocent, even if conniving in the ultimate bureaucrat.
Right.
But he's too likable in a certain way. It would look bad. And it got me like three more months. Nigel Hawthorne was an amazing, we became very close friends up until his death. I was playing his assistant, and you know, he was head guy and of San Angeles or whatever. So after they pump him full of bullets and throw him in the fireplace, I gently go up to Wesley Snipes and say,
what do with you, Bobby?
I am an excellent associate, sir. I would be delighted to continue my services during your administration.
Essentially, what I wanted to show was the ultimate bureaucrat.
Yep.
Like, okay, you viciously slaughtered someone I've been loyal to for years and thrown him in a fire. Can I work for you?
There's a new boss in town.
Everyone mourns differently.
True.
Nigel Hawthorne, I mean, this is a pretty impressive cast list. I mean, you know, especially today, looking back on it, Sandra Bullock, which is one of her earliest roles as Lenina Huxley, Nigel Hawthorne, as you said, Benjamin Bratt, you had Dennis Leary.
A dear guy. Benjamin was wonderful.
And that was one of his earliest roles, too.
Now, Wesley went to Yale. Wesley had a good background, but he both he and Stallone had problems around Nigel. And if you knew Nigel, it's hard to believe. Because, I mean, I know no one else that didn't absolutely worship this man. He's one of the finest men I've ever known. And I spent many, many weeks visiting him in Hertfordshire at his home there. Up until, you know, his death, we were close, and I remain close to his surviving partner. But that was certainly the best thing that came out of the movie for me.
Don't worry. I'll get you with the next shot.
I don't think so. No kiss kiss, no bang bang.
At the time, at first glance, this film appears like it's kind of grafted together from other sci-fi pictures. But yet those recycled bits just keep coming and coming and coming until you realize that, you know, wait a minute, it's not just borrowing a little bit here and there. It's actually almost an homage. Like I said before, it's almost that kitchen sink mentality where even in the background at the fine dining establishment of Taco Bell / Pizza Hut, you have somebody singing in the background the Jolly Green Giant theme song, but he's singing it in kind of a lounge version on the piano.
What a relief!
This is the most popular station in town. Wall-to-wall mini-tunes. You call them commercials.
Here's that classic you've all been waiting for. The number one request of the day. Armor hot dog.
Kids eat Armor hot dog.
Oh, wow. This is my fave.
Kids who climb on rocks. Kids,
sissy kids, even kids with chicken pox love hot dogs.
Armor hot dogs.
The dogs kids love to bite.
I mean, was everyone making this, Glenn, in on the joke, knew that it was, you know, everything was tongue-in-cheek, even though there was extreme violence, even though there was a lot of language, even when people got fined for
Well, yes, and let me say this, and I learned this directly from the editor. I'll never forget it. I was looping. And he said, you know, they made me cut some really beautiful stuff with you and Nigel. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, and it was fly. I said, oh, yeah? He said, yeah. He said, you know, that guy, he's good, but a little of him goes a long way. We had a picture that had even more humor, but a sophisticated humor.
Right.
And you know, it had levels. It was pure ego that he was not going to have Hawthorne and I steal this picture, which is, to me, the saddest thing that happens to stars. You want your picture to be the best picture possible. When your name's above the title, anything good, you want the best for the movie. And I got this from the editor. He was disappointed in what they had done. I was, you know, hey, I'm used to, listen, actors, you do your job, and what ends up on the floor cut is, that's okay. In this case, they really did slash and burn it in terms of what our parts were concerned. I know this sounds just like another actor saying, oh, no, I ain't got my house, it's the best thing. No. There were a lot of great things in it, but there, I know for a fact that a lot of really good stuff that could have worked, that at least the editor believed, was a lot of
that stuff in the script originally, or was it stuff that you and Nigel had come up with?
It was in the script, a lot of it, and then there was. Now we had 2 weeks of rehearsal, which is very rare. It was nice to have that, and that was before Sandra was brought on, but it was most of the rehearsal really was between Nigel, Stallone, and I.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure there were others, but those are the rehearsals that I was involved in.
That is definitely cemented by an interview that was done with Daniel Waters, who was a co-screenwriter of it. And he was talking,
I love Dan Waters.
Well, he was talking about how, you know, the language that was used in this picture, as
he wrote Heathers,
right,
yep.
And
yep.
As you know, as I greeted you with mellow greetings, and but he was saying that it came out of that kind of sterile dialogue came out of advertisements that were, or commercials that came out about rebuilding L.A. after the riots, what, 1991, the Rodney King?
92,
right.
April, I remember well.
These commercials that came out and said, the change starts with you. And he was quoted as saying, you know, these are happy messages that imply that the riot started because everyone was just in a bad mood. And, you know, that signaled to me that, wow, this did come from a place much deeper than just the standard kind of jokey, let's put on a sci-fi show picture that it ultimately was as a result. So it seemed like that there was a lot more under the surface that perhaps we weren't privy to.
Well, and literally under the surface with the people who live below ground.
Quite.
Yep.
Outcasts and deserters who choose to live beneath us in sewers and abandoned tunnels. They're a constant irritation to our harmony.
They're nothing but thugs and hooligans. A society of thieves. The last remaining criminal element in the city. But plans are in progress to purge this peril from our day.
In the original script, there was just one little bit of exposition that explained that I was a eunuch. I played it as a eunuch.
Right.
And without that setup, it just looked odd. But, I mean, that read, I guess, enough. I found a kernel of truth in the person that I, you know, and then just remove the testosterone as much as possible, and then went into the manipulation, trying to continue on and on and on. This, you know, the bureaucrat that survives.
Yeah. And speaking of testosterone, this also starred... not starred, but it also featured Jesse the Body Ventura.
I loved Jesse. We had long, long talks. He was very, very political. And I must say, I changed his mind on one issue, and it took months. But that was about gays in the military. I just, he was adamant at first, but he's very open. He's an open-minded guy. And he's not the least bit homophobic that I could tell, even though we had different positions on that issue. But he came around to accepted on some level what I presented about, it's about behavior, not about lying about who you are.
Right.
Whether it's male-female, male-male, whatever.
Sure.
Behavior, yeah. But to have to lie,
yeah.
It's the same thing with bishops and churches.
Yeah.
You're fine to be a bishop if you lie.
Yeah.
And that, to me, smacks of something totally contradictory to
human nature.
Yeah, and also, my gosh, to truth being a very important element. But I see, and I know so many people in the military now, young people, it's changing. That's going to change. Martin Luther King said, in a democracy, the arc of social justice moves slowly, but it moves slowly forward. And I believe that. We never got into shouting matches either. That was a great thing about Jesse. Jesse's a warm, loving kind of guy.
I can't picture him lowering his voice.
I didn't know what to expect. I really didn't.
Right.
You know, Jesse's a body Ventura. God knows what he's going to think of me. 325 pounds of, fey fat. I mean, oh, Lord, God.
I have, in fact, perused some newsreels from the Schwarzenegger Library, and that time that you took that car...
Hold it. The Schwarzenegger Library?
Yes, the Schwarzenegger Presidential Library. Wasn't he an actor when
you... Stop. He was president?
Yes. Even though he was not born in this country, his popularity at the time caused the 61st Amendment, which states that...
I don't want to know.
Scott, how old were you when you saw this film?
I was probably about 11, 12 years old. Yeah, I'd say probably about 12 years old on VHS tape. Yeah, just love Diane Lane. So I watched Judge Dredd, and then that sort of got me on a action kick. Like, this one was rated R, so this was another one that I had to watch at parents' houses. Friends' parents' houses.
Oh, I forgot
houses.
It was an R.
I loved this movie. And I loved Judge Dredd, and just the whole thing, anything with, like, futuristic sci-fi movies. You know, it's like where it goes, where you're, 10,000 years in the future and everybody's walking slowly on spaceships, that's where you lose me. But this had, like, so many references to things that I knew and so many references to, the three shells is hilarious.
That is funny.
That looks as unsanitary as it does uncomfortable.
Oh, I mean, how is that an improvement?
Yeah.
No idea.
Detective, I am Lieutenant Lenina Huxley. The year is 2032. Now, the reason that you have been released is...
How long have I been under?
36 years. Her light was extinguished in the big one of 2010. She died in an earthquake. The earthquake.
I loved Sandra Bullock's character, how she would explain, the references of, 1996.
Right.
And I just loved her relationship with everybody else, saying that, explaining everything and loving the jingles, and the art design and prop design of her apartment had to be, like, the most fun part of the movie.
The production design was very good on this, and we shot our exteriors and a lot of things in Irvine,
okay.
Which is, oh, my God, it's like this fascist. I mean, not the people so much, well, I hope, but... the look of it, I mean, you don't see anyone of color, even like pumping gas or, I mean, it's just so white, so pristine, so other. It's sterile is what it is.
Whew, that was tense.
That was tense?
Yes.
Tell me something, Garcia. Don't you get bored code-tracing perps who break curfew and tell dirty jokes?
Actually, no. I find my job deeply fulfilling. I just cannot get over the reality of this office, Lenina Huxley. You're still addicted to the 20th century. High from its harshness, buzzed by its brutality. Oh, smokes! I mean, is there anything in this office which doesn't violate Contraband Ordinance 22?
Only you, Alfredo Garcia.
Even though originally Lori Petty was cast and the powers that be, whatever, there was not the right chemistry, whatever, who knows what. She was there, shot one scene, next day, Sandy's there in wardrobe. But Sandy brought such a great energy and such a great tongue. Sandy's so smart and so funny and such a good actress. She lifted that film up. She really did add a lot. She also gave it a longer life. Listen, Laurie worked one day and got, I don't know how many $100,000, but you know, everybody gets the same residuals if you're on it a certain time, except I get double. And the reason being is because I incorporated in the middle, like I said, your residuals are based on days worked or the amount paid, and then you top out at a certain amount. Right. Well, I topped out with my Social Security, and then I stayed on since I talked them into not killing me to get top residuals for my corp. So I get, I'm the only one that gets double residuals. It could never happen again. It could only happen that one time. But it was fine.
Associate Bob was not a stretch for you then.
I was a bit of an, I had some manipulation in me.
But where are the hostages?
They're not here.
What do you mean they're not here?
They must have stashed them someplace else.
So how do you know they weren't in there? Are you sure?
Because I did a thermal check and there was only 8 of them, all part of his gang.
Wrong again.
Hey, you got something to say, scumbag? Get him out of here.
Sly, we had a force majeure. He was in great competition with Wesley, and he was working out too hard, and he busted a vein in his bicep.
See, that's why I don't work out.
But he was, we shut down for, I think, about 2 weeks. Not paid, because it was force majeure, act of God, you know, that sort of thing. Oh, but everybody made a lot of money on that movie, because it went so far over. But I remember one thing that was very funny. Nigel, you know, Nigel Hawthorne, this was before he was knighted, but he was soon to be knighted after he did The Madness of King George. He was so homesick for England. If he had a four-day weekend, he would fly to England. That is quite a trek.
That's devotion.
You it's know? Like you land and you get back on the plane.
He lived in a 500-year-old place. It's called Fabden's. And he bought it from the Pet Shop Boys.
Wow.
It's just this magnificent place. Not a huge castle. It's like their ceilings are low. They're beautiful cottages. It's all 15th century, you know, with a river that runs through it, 5 acres of formal gardens, 2 full-time gardeners. Mm-hmm. And what looks like from the outside a 15th century cottage, open the door, blonde wood on both sides, palms, and an Olympic-sized pool. I remember us sitting in on the set, and, you know, there's a lot of banging and crashing, and, you know, when you're making a movie in Hollywood, he said, God, it's like a factory. I said, well, Nigel, it is.
Yeah. Like, that's how it started.
You're surprised? Yeah. It's totally a factory. We're at Warner Brothers, and we're cranking out a film.
Right.
And he was used to a much, well, for one thing, a lot of theater, but the tone on the sets of British films, it's just a different... Hey, we Americans, we're loud, we're brash, we bang things around, you know.
Joel Silver's here.
It was a little culture shock for him. You know, Stallone would go, and we're having a take, and there's a scene, it was an outdoor scene. Nigel prepares, and he likes for there to be some quiet before action. Sly will talk all the way, talking about me talking, you know, like a sailor, up until action. They had it going on, then the contrast between Stallone and Hawthorne couldn't have been greater, and there was really no love lost between those two.
I'll tell you what, if I do a film here or for our podcast, will you at least come on and pretend to be Sylvester Stallone, and we can just say we have him on as a guest? Because
that was really great.
You do a pitch perfect.
Oh, it ain't no problem. Good.
So you think you're taking me in, huh? Guess what? Not happening. You tell Cocteau he can kiss my ass. Yeah, that's right. You tell Cocteau it's going to take an army of assholes to get rid of me, because I don't give a shit. I got nothing to lose.
And, you know, another breath of fresh air who came in later in the movie was Dennis Leary. I really liked him. And he said, how do you feel about fat jokes? I said, well, you know, we've kind of avoided them. It's obvious. I'm big. Why not go for something more interesting? So he came up with a line about, oh, God, you look like a couch. That was new to him. But I appreciated him being, you know, courteous enough to ask. It wouldn't have offended me greatly. I mean, my God, that was the biggest I ever was on film.
I'm the enemy, because I like to think. I like to read. I'm into freedom of speech and freedom of choice. I'm the kind of guy who likes to sit in a greasy spoon and wonder, gee, should I have the T-bone steak or the jumbo rack of barbecue ribs with the side order of gravy fries? I want high cholesterol. I want to eat bacon and butter and buckets of cheese, okay? I want to smoke a Cuban cigar the size of Cincinnati in a non-smoking section. I want to run through the streets naked with green jello all over my body reading Playboy magazine. Why? Because I suddenly might feel the need to, okay, pal? I've seen the future. You know what it is? It's a 47-year-old virgin sitting around in his beige pajamas drinking a banana broccoli shake singing, I'm an Oscar Mayer wiener.
And he was funny. Oh, man, and had stories. So he was a nice shot. And, you know, Jack Black was in that film.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
And I told the casting director, I said, I'd worked with Jack. We did an Actors Gang production of Blood in the Eye of the Cat. We also had hits. We have Wesley, you know, Wesley was, I got along fine with Wesley because when they wrapped Nigel, I felt like, oh my God, it's going to be me and Sly and Wesley in the cryo prison for a month. And, you know, yeah, I'll tell you, at the height of vulnerability, this is it. On comes Sly with the Italian mafia behind him. And then comes on Wesley. His entourage, huge. Boom, 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 boom. Here I come on in a silk kimono, flip-flop, and nary a fluffer. All by myself. This big, fat, gay eunuch, or whatever. It was like, oh my God. Oh, my God. It harkened back to horrifying days in elementary school. You know, and this place was actually very, very cold. And you had to watch out because the drops that would come down, they would burn. It was some sort of...
like dry ice thing?
Yeah, yeah. But you had to watch out because it really burned. At one point, they were shooting at me, and they were shooting pellets. And they hurt like hell when they hit you.
Scott, as a duty-bound contributor to Nonsakashi, you rewatched this for the sake of the podcast. What have you noticed or picked up?
As you get older, you get more of the jokes.
Yeah.
And you realize how much of it is... subtle, and how much of it just really is funny. For as much as explosions and Wesley Snipes sidekicks there are in the movie, because he loves to kick sideways, that it just really is funny and just a high-quality movie.
I love the little fines that you got for cursing.
Look, I don't need a history lesson. Come on, Hal! Where the goddamn guns?
You are fined 1 credit for a violation of the verbal morality standard.
Fuck you!
Your repeated violation of the verbal morality statute has caused me to notify the San Angeles Police Department. Please remain where you are for your own command.
Yeah, right.
last year I did my top 100 favorite movies, and these are the ones that are just, I think, are the best movies, and I can watch them over and over and over again. And I looked it up this afternoon, and Demolition Man was number 54, right between Dirty Harry and Boys in the Hood.
And, you know, I don't want to come off like I'm bashing Stallone, because he was nice to me. Stallone is who he is, you know, and he had a lot riding on this. He'd had a hit, Cliffhanger, and they had to grab a hold of that energy and get this thing out. And also, you know, you could feel that he knew that his time was passing. You know, it's been a slide a bit since then, but you know, you only have a certain amount of time. Boy,
but
he
now,
is a good runner. I have a great respect for him, because what he did with the original Rocky was a magnificent story.
Greetings and salutations. I'm Associate Bob. We met before, ever so briefly. I was groveling in fear at the time.
You got the salt over there, Bob?
Just got back from a great Tennessee Williams Festival in Provincetown. One of my great mentors actually directed me in the play that Tim saw me in that got me the role of Otho. This is the fourth year, and they had 10 plays, and they did some amazing things, and it ended up a complete sellout. It was a great boost to the end of the season for Provincetown, and artistically, you had just some of the finest actors. My manager from L.A. came, all my New York friends. It was, and we all stayed right. David stays there. He has Eugene O'Neill's old place right on the beach, and I stayed across the street at the Waterford, and it was like, you know, it's a little tiny village, and when it's full of artists and full of great plays, I mean, when you get 10 plays in 4 days,
wow,
that's a lot coming at you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it really was enriching. I've put up a few things, but I'm about to put up a major thing on my blog about the whole event. Because I'm so proud for David. He's really created this. He had two world premieres, plays that have never been seen before. He has a real understanding of, especially, Williams' later work, which was more absurdist. But they did the classics, too. They flew in. Get this. I'll end with this quickly. They had a cast of A Streetcar Named Desire. The entire cast flew from Auckland, New Zealand, rehearsed and ready, all the way to Provincetown. That's like 30 hours.
Yeah.
Or something like that. I mean, it's an ungodly trip. And they were not flying first class. So, you can imagine. But they were wonderful. They were wonderful. It's something I highly recommend to anyone who's involved or interested in theater or Williams or whatever.
You can check out more on this at twptown.org, and it's got information
great
on that.
You are right, Rob. You are on top of it.
Well, we try, Glenn. We try to come prepared. We come to play ball.
Thank you.
Happy, happy
I hope
thoughts.
People will check out www.glenn2nshaddix.com.
Yes. We will have a link provided as well on our site to that as well. So
this has been fun as always with you, Rob and Scott.
For us too, Glenn. I definitely appreciate you you strolling down memory lane with us. It's always a pleasure, and I can't wait to have you back.
I can't wait to come back.
All right, gentlemen. Have a great weekend and
happy, happy, joy, joy.
Happy, happy, joy, joy. Be well. All right, take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, Glenn.
All right. Bye.
Got to the chair and the bomb is ticking. The situation was not of your picking. You say that this wasn't in your plan. Don't mess around with the demolition man. Walking nightmare and arsenal of doom. I feel conversation that I want to do. I'm a freelance bit, I'm a solid in defense. I'm a walking disaster, I'm a demolition man.
have a peachy day, Lieutenant. Be well.
Be well.